So I backed up a little bit, as I'm sure you noticed, and really read last week's gospel and this week's so that we can hear them together, because it's a little unclear why the framers of the lectionary divided them. It's one incident. He begins to read the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, and then things start turning for him rather quickly. And so I want to talk a little bit about, again, this encounter with Jesus and his hometown folks at Nazareth, but put that more generally in the context of the prophet, because we also hear in the Old Testament, we hear the call of the prophet Jeremiah. And to be a prophet is an interesting phenomenon within the Jewish world. And just a few words about that. I think I might have even mentioned last week how indebted I am to the Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann in his book, The Prophetic Imagination, where he says, contrary to our common belief that the prophet is angry and is wagging his finger all the time and is denouncing, Brueggemann says that the beginning of a prophetic sensibility is the experience of grief. And it's social grief. It is, the prophet begins as one who is open-hearted and sees the suffering of those generally in the society, and every society has them, the suffering of those who are considered marginal or expendable. Whatever society it might be, every society has members that don't really count, that are not fully members of that social group. And the prophet sees those invisible ones and grieves for it, and then begins to speak. And it's interesting, because prophecy you might think of as social criticism. The prophet is the one to whom it is given that they have insight. They have the capacity to understand the situation at a deeper level than the general society. And so they can see the unfolding of events before other people. They can see the consequences that are about to come down upon people. And unlike so much of our public discourse now, which I think we can probably agree is not very constructive, when we hear politicians and candidates talking about issues, I'm not getting a lot of light or insight from that. And I think it's important to remember that genuine prophetic speech still adheres to that Christian mandate, speak the truth in love. Speak the truth in love, even in social situations. And so the truly prophetic speech is not going to be playing one group off against another. It's not going to be making political points by blaming someone else. It is going to hold a view of a social reality and ask everyone to be accountable and be responsible. And so the prophet is really speaking to the best, if somewhat unrealized, side of human beings. Not telling one group how terrible some other group is, which simply divides the body. So you get this call, the call of Jeremiah. He was one of those unhappy prophets, because it was given to him to live during the time leading up to the great defeat of Israel at the hands of the Babylonian armies. And so Jeremiah sort of was a public figure in those years leading up to the great defeat of Israel and their descent into slavery and captivity in Babylon. And he was saying, this is happening, this is coming, don't you see it? And he was, of course, always regarded as a traitor for speaking an unpleasant but necessary truth. And it seems Jesus did the same thing. And I will have to say, I don't really, you know, I've never really understood why he says, physician, heal thyself, or is it today, doctor, cure thyself. I am always struck by the courage of Jesus, because at the beginning, everybody was speaking well of him. And we have to recognize that as something that all of us, come on in, all of us would give up reluctantly. If people are on your side, do you want to keep going and just say the thing that is going to make them angry? Usually not. Jesus was courageous. And whatever it was that, I don't really know what made the people so angry. What he was referring to, this sense that, the messianic world, the messianic promise is being fulfilled. But the messianic promise turns out to be different than that group at Nazareth understood it to be. And the big difference is Jesus started talking about foreigners, started talking about the people that were outside the group. And if you'll remember from last week, Jesus did not read the sentence from Isaiah that said, and the day of vengeance for our God. Vengeance was out. And who knows, the people there might have expected vengeance on Israel's enemies, those around the perimeter. And instead of vengeance, they hear from Jesus inclusion. These people are also part of God's working, even the Syrians. Again, our understanding of God is too small unless it includes everyone. I will probably say that every week until I go away. Our understanding of God is too small unless it includes everyone. And Jesus was expanding their understanding of who God is. And they hated it. They said, no, that's not the God we want. We want a God who is for us, who is going to help us and defeat our enemies. And Jesus says, actually, God doesn't see enemies in quite the same way. God isn't against anybody. God is for everyone. And that seems to be a pretty powerful nerve that gets touched. And it still is getting touched when we try to ponder the world and our place in it and figure out how we can see the world and all the different players, so many of whom are in conflict, how we can see that as all held by the one creative presence of God. Still not very easy. So I want to talk also about the wedding passage. We get to hear 1 Corinthians 13, which for most of us, we only hear at weddings. And while it certainly does have a private dimension, and not a bad passage to use also as a meditation. And the challenge that comes to us from this passage, the distilled challenge of this passage is this. Paul says, no matter what you're doing, no matter what you are doing, if it does not come from a place of love, it's worthless. Try that one on. Again, as a meditation, which begins to break down any divisions that we might have. Is there a separate sacred realm and a secular realm? Paul would say no. The Celts would say no. It's one realm. Are there things that God is not concerned about? Is there, you know, the way we spend our money, do our recreation, be political? Are any of those things outside the realm of God's concern? And Paul would say, no. Everything we do, every act we take, has to be understood in the context of love. And if we are intending the good, and if we are intending the well-being of those who will be affected by our action, go ahead. But if we cannot understand what we are about to do in terms of love, I mean, I would say that is a primary act of discernment. And you would say, okay, well, if I can't figure out how this is going to be a loving act, don't do it. Very simple. Don't do it. Allow that. And you can even kind of play with that. If you're ever thinking of doing something, imagine saying grace, like giving thanks for the fruit that this action will bring forth. And if you can't do that, if when you try to pray over an act and you realize, oh, actually, this is going to cause misunderstanding and deepen the sense of conflict between us, probably do something else. You know, again. So this passage, hugely important for the centrality of love. And then there's some interesting little tidbits in it. When it says love does not rejoice in wrongdoing, in the Greek it says it keeps no account of wrongs. Love keeps no account of wrongs. So there's no scorecard. That would probably be a better world for all of us to live in. And this sense of rejoicing in wrongdoing, he says love doesn't rejoice in wrongdoing. The way I've come to understand that is not that you see somebody behaving destructively and you go, yay, but rather, say there's a guy who pretty much every time you meet him comes off as self-centered and arrogant. And he's known that way throughout the town. So that you're going to go to a meeting with him. Is there some part of you secretly that hopes he shows himself to be arrogant and self-centered again today so that your preconceptions can be justified and confirmed? That would be rejoicing in wrongdoing. And the alternate would be to go to that meeting saying, well, maybe this guy has been arrogant and self-centered 100 times, but I don't know how he's going to be today. Love bears all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Even somebody arrogant and self-centered at a meeting where you say, maybe there will be an invitation or a space. And then another, I love this, I don't quite know where to go with it exactly. This little question of we see, and it's translated today, we see in a mirror darkly. Not quite right. The preposition is through. We see through, so we're not seeing our reflection. And it's not darkly. The Greek word is we see enigmatically. We see enigmas. You remember, many of you might know that word enigma from World War II history. The Enigma machine was the encryption machine used by the Germans to encrypt their communications. And we got one of those machines from a submarine that we captured, and the Germans didn't know it. And so they were thinking their communications were still encrypted, and we were reading them because we could decode them. But an enigma, it's mysterious, it's hard to understand. We see enigmatically, we see enigmas through the glass. And, you know, I think that is a better way to approach the world. The world, I say it all the time, we as human beings don't really know what we're doing here. And this kind of points in that direction. We see enigmas. We see things that are not clear to us immediately. When we are confronting an enigmatic world, we are in a position to begin asking questions. We are in a position to experience ourselves with a little greater and appropriate humility, that we don't understand some things, and that maybe we walk respectfully and cautiously and inquisitively without the arrogance that can so often drive us, as if we knew what we were doing, as if we really knew what it meant to be a human being on this little planet. I love that word, enigma, that things are enigmatic to us would seem to heal so much of the shouting and the blaming and the fighting as if we were certain about what we're fighting about. Let the world be mysterious. You know that great great saying of the Celts. The places where the veil is thin between the worlds, and yet we're saying that place is everywhere. And part of what it means to be sensitive to that and aware of that, to approach things with love, start with the simplest act of paying attention, of being present to that which you're actually experiencing. That is a way of, that is like the first step in doing what you do with love. Love the mystery of this world. Love the mystery of your personal relations. Love the mystery of conflict working itself out in history. Love it all. Love it all. That's what Paul is saying to us. There is no thing that we could possibly do that would not be made better if our hearts were open and our eyes as clear as possible, that we might see the true mystery that is all around us. Amen.